Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Anna Staber. The grocery store aisle dedicated to deodorant can feel overwhelming. Do you need an antiperspirant? How about one with shea butter? An exfoliant? What about ones with aluminum? Doesn't that cause cancer? Here to help us separate all those facts from fiction is Dr. Brooke Jeffy, a board-certified dermatologist who is also the founder of Gen Alpha, a teen and tween skincare brand. Welcome back to All Sides.
Thank you, Anna. Great to be back.
So let's start with antiperspirants, because I think they're the ones that get the bad rap, specifically because the active ingredient, aluminum, is supposedly linked to all kinds of things from breast cancer to Alzheimer's. So let's start with those claims. Do they have any merit?
They really don't. This idea comes from suggestions put forth many years ago and small association studies with patients with some of these conditions like breast cancer and Alzheimer's, as well as small studies done on animals or in breast cancer cells in petri dishes. There is really no good scientific evidence that shows that these are concerns in humans. So many associations have come out stating, the American Cancer Society for one, stating that these are false claims.
What is the purpose of aluminum in deodorant? Because it just, like, when I think aluminum, I think like tinfoil.
Well, one thing to clear up is that often people say the word deodorant, meaning both antiperspirant or deodorant, and these are two totally separate products. So with antiperspirants, the aluminum salts are the active ingredient that help to control sweating. So they actually work by blocking the release of sweat onto the surface of the skin. So that is what aluminum, that is how it works as an active, is it prevents this wetness from getting to the surface of the skin. And it is that moisturizer, that moisture that leads to the bacteria on our skin breaking it down and causing odor. So it works totally different than deodorants. Deodorants simply rely on some sort of scent to cover that odor. Some of them will also have things that help absorb moisture, so maybe like baking soda or some sort of powder, but they work in two different ways.
That's good to know. And I gotta ask though, so antiperspirants stop you from sweating, but isn't sweating the way our body naturally like cools and regulates its temperature?
So that is true. However, when we are thinking about just eliminating this process or minimizing really this process in one small area, it is not affecting body-wide sweating and your cooling mechanisms.
But maybe don't put it all over your body for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, but I think not many people are attempting to do that, but using it in localized areas, you can actually use antiperspirants, for example, on like hyperhidrosis, which means excessive sweating on the palms and soles, can also help there, but not body-wide.
Is there any reason why you might recommend that someone choose a deodorant instead of an antiperspirant?
I think if someone doesn't really experience excessive sweating, and they maybe want to avoid, a product they don't need, then it would be reasonable to choose a deodorant. But I don't like people thinking that deodorants are necessarily safer because, again, these rely often on scents and fragrance to cover odor. And those are not without risk. In fact, fragrance is the most common contact allergen, meaning that it can lead to itchy rashes on the skin. And so just like to point out that those are not without risk either.
Oh, that answers my next question, because I was going to ask about that. So some scenting products, like especially essential oils that you might see in a deodorant, that can cause skin irritation.
Exactly. So these products tend to rely on botanicals, plant extracts, essential oils, and these are not without risk to the skin, particularly when you're putting it on thinner skin like the armpit. And it's an area that tends to rub. It really kind of rubs these ingredients into the skin. So people have this misconception that just because these are maybe plant-derived natural products that they're safe and without risk. And again, that is just not the case.
And, deciding whether you want to smell like a desert bloom or mountain rain, it's really a personal preference. But what's fascinating about fragrance to me is that while most people enjoy the way they make you smell, they give about 12% of the population headaches and different reactions. Like some people are very scent sensitive.
Yeah, that's very true. These products are definitely a very personal experience in general into like what products you may decide to use. But yes, if you are overdoing it or you're with someone that is incredibly sensitive, it's definitely something to think about because some of these products are very potent with their smell.
And so I think that answers the question of like natural or products that are marketed as natural deodorants. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're safer for you to use. But what the heck does natural mean in the context of deodorants anyway?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's really not a regulated term. So any brand can basically say that it's natural. There's no regulation, there's no consequences of that term, of using that term. It is purely marketing and creating a problem when really there isn't one. So, I mean, in this case, they're relying on using the term natural to say it's better than using a typical deodorant or antiperspirant, which we talked about already is not necessarily even a problem. So, again, these natural products don't mean without risk, definitely can cause contact dermatitis. I always give the example of poison ivy, for example. You know, that's a plant, that's natural, gives most of us allergic contact dermatitis.
That is a very good point. You would not want poison ivy in your deodorant.
Exactly.
Can antiperspirants be manufactured without aluminum, or is that like the secret sauce to their effectiveness?
Yeah, I mean, that is the point of antiperspirants is to block those sweat glands so that the sweat they produce does not get to the surface. So there are other products that can do that in the prescription realm, meaning like they reduce the sweat to get to the surface of the skin. So there are oral and topical medications called anticholinergics. So again, they work a little bit differently, but still stopping the sweat from getting to the surface. So there are other ways to do that, but not necessarily in over-the-counter products.
And that doesn't sound like the kind of thing your doctor is just going to prescribe to you.
Well, you know, I hate to actually see people struggle with hyperhidrosis and excessive odor because there are good treatments in the right person. But usually people can manage this with over-the-counter products. But if someone is struggling, it's affecting their self-esteem, it's affecting how they, interact with people at work, or if it's a child, I would certainly see a dermatologist because there are many other choices that you may not have thought of if over-the-counter isn't working.
And, for people who aren't struggling that far, so I guess what we might call average sweaters, do we even need deodorant or antiperspirant?
I would say you don't need it unless you don't want to offend others by your odor, potentially.
Yeah, I guess like, it's just one of those questions, like, do I even need to bother with this?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it depends on your personal comfort level with how much moisture you produce, what odor that results in, and whether or not you want to use these things. Of course, it's a personal choice.
I have to ask, there's always been this rumor, myth, I don't know what it is. Is there any truth to this idea that if you start using antiperspirants, like basically that you're going to start to smell more, that it's like a vicious cycle where like if you get quote unquote hooked on them, you're going to need them?
There is no, that is a myth. That is a myth. There is no basis for that.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So it sounds like when you're trying to decide between deodorant and antiperspirant or any kind of scent, it just sounds like it's personal preference. And, what might make you break out is not going to be what makes me break out.
Exactly. That's very true. And you can get products that are fragrance-free, for example. So if you're someone who does tend to break out, maybe you stick with those products. Like I said, if you're someone who doesn't really sweat a lot, you might be comfortable just using a deodorant. You may not need the aluminum benefits there. So it really is just kind of a personal decision. And then also in terms of like what scents you like, and that sort of thing. The other thing that I would mention is that the odor, again, it comes from bacteria that break down sweat on the surface of the skin into byproducts that have an odor. So even doing antimicrobial cleansers occasionally under the armpit, that's another option that can take you away from the deodorant antiperspirant question if that works for you.
Oh, that's interesting. So, do you mean like those wipes, or is there like antimicrobial soap?
Yeah, antimicrobial cleansers, so bar soaps, benzoyl peroxide cleansers, these can all reduce the bacteria in that area, which may help your odor.
Oh, that's really good to know. So there is this concern out there about how much aluminum we're exposed to collectively on a daily basis. So like food, water, antiperspirants, like Is do you have any sense of the research into whether cumulatively it becomes a problem? So it's like not a problem in the deodorant, and it's not necessarily a problem in the water, but you put them all together and that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me, and I'm definitely not an expert in sort of like all those environmental exposures, but from what I have read, it seems like these more systemic ingestible exposures over time are going to contribute more to that cumulative exposure. I mean, when you're just applying aluminum into such a small area, like for armpits, for example, what amount that contributes, difficult to say. But I think these other systemic exposures just make sense that they would be more relevant. But again, what that means, I mean, aluminum is pretty ubiquitous in our environment as well.
Since you have a skincare line focused on tweens and teens, I wanted to ask, is there any special considerations, like as our children are, going through puberty and starting to consider deodorant, is there any special restrictions for kids?
There's really not. I say the same thing to parents as we kind of already talked about. I mean, if your kiddo is struggling with, excessive sweating, they are smelling, I mean, please do not withhold products that, will help them control that. You don't want to be them to be ridiculed, bullied, things like that for an issue that they could easily control. So I think I mean, again, I think the risk is essentially zero, but I definitely think the benefit here strongly outweighs the risk. I have no qualms about having tweens and teens use aluminum products or deodorant if they need it. I mean, they need it usually.
Yeah. My final question is just a personal one that I've been curious about. Why is it that stress sweat always seems to smell so much worse than, say, physical activity sweat?
I think it's just because you're sweating more. There's more of that moisture on the skin. That's an interesting question. It kind of I'm not sure that I've never seen any information about like the breakdown of that happening more with your microbiome or anything like
Maybe
that.
it's just a hyper awareness of it.
It may be that too, and just the sheer amount of sweat you're pumping out.
That was Dr. Brooke Jeffy. She's a dermatologist and the founder of Gen Alpha and teen and tween skincare brand BTWN. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're talking about everything you have ever wanted to know about cataract surgery. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Cataract surgery is the most commonly performed surgery in the world, with more than 4 million Americans undergoing the procedure each year. By the time we reach 80, half of us will have cataracts. Here to explain what they are and what you need to know is Dr. Alan Stiegelman. He's the Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Florida. Go Gators. And he's performed thousands of cataract surgeries. Dr. Alan, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, and I appreciate that introduction. Very happy to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
So what are cataracts exactly, and how do they form in your eyes?
Well, in general, the cataracts that we're talking about today are ones that usually come along with age. And I joke with patients and say birthdays are the most common reason that people get cataracts. There are other reasons, trauma, certain medication exposures, radiation exposure, things like that. But that's a much lower fraction of the total. For most folks, it's birthdays and just living. And we get into our 60s, 70s, they become visually significant. They're a cloudiness in the lens inside the eye. Some folks have a misconception that there's a growth on the surface of the eye, and that's not really what this is. It's actually the lens inside the eye. It gets cloudy. I tell patients it's like a bathroom window. It gets slowly smokier and smokier over time until it gets to the point that it just clouds vision to where a patient's not functional anymore.
And they can form in all different parts of the eye, correct?
Well, so no, the cataract is really in the lens of the eye.
No, I meant like across the lens. Like they could start in the corner of your eye, the center of your eye, like over. Is that correct or no?
Well, yeah, you can get different parts of the lens can get cloudy. So we have, you know, ones in the front or back. If I think of the lens like an M&M, a plain one, not peanut, there's a candy outside and there's the chocolate inside. The older age cataracts, usually the chocolate inside is getting cloudier. Usually when we see cataracts in younger patients, it's the candy coating that gets cloudier first. And oftentimes it'll get cloudy in like spokes. We call it cortical spoking. Reminds me of the wagon wheel of old timey wagons that little spokes of cloudiness can develop. And that usually shows up younger in life than the typical nuclear sclerosis.
So you briefly touched on this before, but certain conditions like diabetes, they can contribute to the onset or of cataracts.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do see cataracts earlier in life in folks who have diabetes, and they seem to have the cortical kind more so than the folks with the nuclear, inside the heart of the lens type.
What about vices like smoking and drinking? Do they make a difference?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this has been debated some. It seems that whatever we already know we should be doing for our health, whether it's eating right and exercise and not smoking, et cetera, that seems to go along with staving off cataract development. There have been some lifestyle factors that have been implicated in cataract development, including UV exposure. But that's a little controversial because some of these lifestyle studies that look at stuff like UV exposure have looked at, for instance, like roofers and other folks that have outdoor activities. And it's difficult to control for, their access to healthcare, their utilization of various vitamins, et cetera, et cetera. So those are difficult studies to really know what to think from.
That's interesting. So it sounds like you're saying, wear your sunglasses or a baseball cap when you're outside.
I think it couldn't hurt for sure. Absolutely.
So when does it come time to have surgery? Is that just a personal decision when your vision gets impaired to the point where you'd like to do something about it?
That's precisely right. And so some patients will come to us referred from other centers and they misunderstand, they've got this dreaded diagnosis of a cataract and they think they have to have urgent surgery. And no, a surgery for cataracts is elective. So a patient gets to choose the timing You know, there are exceptions in trauma and some other situations, of course, but by and large, when it comes to cataract surgery for most folks, it's when they're bothered by it, when their vision finally gets to the point that they can't do what they want to do, whether it's drive, it's work, it's watch TV, whatever affects their quality of life, that's when it's time for cataract surgery.
Let's talk about the surgery itself. On average, how long does it take to actually, what are you actually doing to the eye to correct it, and how long does that take?
Yeah, so I tell patients that on average they're in the room between 20 and 30 minutes, but it can be a few hours actually at the OR center because patients have to get their IV started and they have to get 100 dilating drops and do all the paperwork and whatnot. But actually, in the room time is relatively brief. Once we get the patient in the room, we get the eye sterilized and cleaned, usually with a betadine solution. We get them positioned comfortably under our operating microscope. And for most patients these days, they're awake. They get some sedation in the IV. I joke with patients, say it's like three margaritas all at once. So they're nice and relaxed. And then we make a small incision between the clear and the white of the eye. And through the dilated pupil, we make a small opening in the lens capsule, which is like a little clear balloon that holds the lens. And then we use a little ultrasound device. It's kind of like a teeny jackhammer. And it breaks the lens into little bitty pieces that we can then aspirate with vacuum power through this small device and clean up all the remaining lens particles out of the capsule. And then we'll usually fold up a plastic lens that's as close to the glasses power that patient would need to see well. And then we put that back into that lens capsule. Most of the time, we do not need to put a stitch or a suture in the eye because the incisions we make are mostly self-sealing. And we apply some drops, and then we discharge the patient to home
Oh my
after a
goodness.
real short recovery period.
I don't know that I'd want to be awake for all that. Oh my goodness.
It goes quickly. It does. Most patients seem to be underwhelmed. I think just like you're saying, most patients show up with a lot of anxiety, and they're very nervous about what's going to happen. But then when it's all over, frequently we hear it, that's it, that's all there was. And so it's very well tolerated most of the time.
So what is the recovery like?
So for most patients with routine surgery, they can see pretty well the next day. And we don't have many limitations for patients as far as what their activity levels are, except for straining. So if folks have cataract surgery, especially, we do not put the sutures in. I don't want patients lifting anything more than about 10 pounds. I don't want them bending over. I don't like them to get their eye below their heart. I like them to keep their head up when they're bending over to put shoes on, for instance, things like that. I don't want patients to get into water. So like a pool or a hot tub, I don't want them to get junk in their eye. That goes with yard work or mowing the grass. I actually had a patient just recently who wanted me to write him a note for his wife that he didn't have to do lawn work for 6 months. I told him he'd have to take that up with his wife, but I only want those limitations usually for the first couple of weeks after surgery during the healing phase.
No, that makes sense. So basically, take it easy in the weeks
Right.
afterwards. What's interesting is it sounds like a different kind of recovery than LASIK.
Yeah, so with LASIK, I do that surgery as well. In fact, I just did one a little while ago. We do not enter the eye. And so we're less concerned about, surges of pressure into the head with lifting weights and doing downward dog in yoga class. Those things are less of a concern. I still have limitations about getting junk in the eye for the first few weeks. So no yard work, no hot tubs or pools, things like that.
So, because it's elective surgery, it is not, well, rarely, if ever, covered by your insurance plan. So, what are we talking about in terms of price?
No, cataract surgery is almost always
Oh,
covered by
okay.
insurance. Yeah, it is because it's elective doesn't necessarily mean it's not necessary.
Okay.
The elective nature, it's kind of like a knee replacement. A patient needs the knee replacement to be mobile, but they often can dictate that timing to some
Oh,
extent.
okay. That's what elective means here.
That's what I'm sorry. Yeah, that's what
No,
elective means.
that's
No.
really good information. So it's more about when you're choosing to do it, not how much you're going to pay for it.
Precisely, precisely. So most insurance does cover cataract surgery. One exception is in sometimes the type of lens that we use in the eye. So we've been using what we call a monofocus or one focus lens that we put back in the eye. We've been using that for a few decades now, and it works very well for most people, but it only offers the opportunity to see one distance clearly without glasses. Most of the time, patients choose distance, like driving, TV, that sort of thing. And then they'll wear over-the-counter cheaters like I wear from, a drugstore for, $8 or $10 to be able to read. Now, in recent years, over the last decade or so, maybe going back to the, early 2000s, there have been multifocal lenses available. So they can actually act like bifocals or even trifocals. And they can give distance, they can give computer, and they can give reading vision. Those lenses are typically not covered by insurance, and they can be substantial out of pocket along the lines of several thousand dollars per eye. For those lenses above what insurance pays. And that cost can vary from surgery center to surgery center.
So that's something to really think about, though, because it sounds like instinctively it sounds nice to have something that would be multifocal.
It is. And most patients who have those lenses are quite happy with them. There are a small number of patients who are not a good fit for those lenses. If anything else is going wrong in the eye, if a patient has a history of diabetes in the eye or glaucoma or macular degeneration, those lenses may not be the best fit for them because if other parts of the eye aren't working well, those multifocal lenses may not work well. And some folks who have very detail-oriented personalities who really fixate on the small things, they may look at some of the potential negatives of the lenses. Above and beyond what some of the potential positives are. So one of the most common side effects that patients notice with the multifocal lenses are usually halos or rings around light sources, like around headlights or streetlights and that sort of thing. For most folks, that see them, they just are aware of them and they maybe are mildly annoying, but not a big deal. But there are a small number of patients who are really bothered and they don't feel comfortable driving at night. Or doing things because of the glare halos. And so those are definitely not a good fit for those lenses.
It sounds a little bit like you're describing night blindness.
Well, not exactly. The night blindness we think of as folks who may not be able to see the stars or see things in the dark, navigate their house with only a night light on, that sort of thing. This is more so like a glare phenomenon from a light source. So if they're out, the most common thing is driving at night. So they complain, these patients complain that it seems like the other drivers have their high beams on, even when they don't. And they just can't tell exactly where the car is in the lane is a common complaint I hear. I think things like that. I have had some reports of pilots who try to land an airplane at night on a runway, and glare can make it very difficult for them to judge depth and judge altitude. So I can see a situation where that could be very disturbing for a patient.
So if somebody, a lot of times because this is surgery that's being performed on older adults, maybe they're nearsighted or farsighted already. Does this have any kind of correction for that, or can you do like a two for one, or are you still just going to need the glasses you always wear?
No, that's a great question. So actually these days our calculators are quite good and we are able to, whether it's a single vision or a multifocal lens, we're typically able to calculate what the equivalent of the patient's glasses would need to be. And at least 85% of the time, sometimes more, we can get folks that to where they don't need glasses for at least that one zone of vision. So it's a refractive procedure most of the time now.
So it isn't LASIK, but it's kind of like getting LASIK with your cataract surgery.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I get some folks to come in that are in their 60s that are thinking about LASIK, but then I notice that they have some cataract changes and we discuss this very issue. And then they can achieve their goals with cataract surgery that they thought they were attempting to with LASIK.
What's the average age at which they first start appearing in people's eyes?
Well, that's a funny question. So it depends on the semantics. So just the other day, I was telling one of my resident trainees with me that we saw in a 40-year-old patient that they had a little yellowing of the lens. Their vision was still perfect, and they did not have any limits at that point. But by definition, the yellowing of the lens, things were starting to get a little cloudy. I don't see that cloudiness in a teenager, for instance. But as we age, the birthdays just start to catch up with us and we see some clouding. And over time, that clouding finally gets to the point where it becomes noticeable to the patient. And that's when it's time for surgery. But that's usually not into the 50s, 60s range or beyond.
It seems like such a great innovation that because prior to surgery, there really wasn't much you could do about them, right? Your vision just got a little cloudier and cloudier each year.
No, that's very true. There are discussions in the medical literature that go back thousands of years, where practitioners from other cultures, they would use a procedure that was called couching. They would use what looked kind of like a needle, and they would insert that into the eye and
Oh,
basically
gosh.
just move the lens out of the way. Remember, I was describing the little capsule or bag that the lens sits in, and we work very diligently to keep that bag intact and be able to put the plastic lens back in there after we're done. Well, in the olden days, they would just poke the whole thing out of the way and it would sink into the back of the eye. So the patient then could then at least get a little more light into the eye. They wouldn't see clearly because they didn't have the lens, but it would be better than the super cloudy lens in the way that they had before. And so, yes, what we have now is much, much, much better.
I am not sure I would want somebody a couple hundred years ago just coming at me with a needle to like shove that little lens into the back of my
I think I would struggle with that myself as well.
I imagine that's the anxiety that a lot of people feel when they come to you about having this kind of surgery. Like having your eye cut open just feels fundamentally like uneasy.
No, that's a great point. What's interesting about vision is it's one of the top concern. Trouble with vision is one of the top concerns in health surveys from year in, year out. In fact, I have seen some surveys in the past that even rank blindness above death. So when people rank their biggest health concerns, cancer or death or whatever, blindness ranks right up there near the top. So I totally understand the apprehension that some people have.
Are there any risks that we should be aware of with the surgery?
Oh, sure. So thankfully, the risks are very, very low number. Our techniques these days are quite successful in just about everybody. But what I report to patients before surgery, as we're having the preoperative discussion, is there are a few potentially vision-threatening complications that can occur after cataract surgery that may cause a loss of vision that may not be able to be fixed. That can include infections in the eye, that can include bleeding in the wall of the eye, or that can include something that's called a retinal detachment. And the retina is, to use a camera analogy, we're talking about the lens here. The retina is kind of like the film, or it's kind of like wallpaper on the back of the wall of the eye. And after cataract surgery, sometimes that wallpaper can come loose, and then the film won't work and process an image anymore. But of those three things, the infection, the bleeding, the retinal detachment, those are thankfully incredibly rare. In most studies, they report a few in 10,000, maybe as many as one in 1,000, but a very rare event. And if a patient presents soon enough after having one of those complications, most of the time our treatments are quite successful in giving very useful vision. There are many other, what I consider milder complications and more annoyances, that with enough time, enough extra procedures or extra medications, we usually can get patients to a very good spot. It just may take a little longer.
That was Dr. Alan Stiegelman. He's an associate professor of ophthalmology at the University of Florida. Thank you so much for your time and your information today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Coming up, how to apologize like you mean it. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, it seems to me the siren seems to be the hardest word.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. And if the music is any indication, we're going to be talking about saying I'm sorry. Because apologies are not created equal. And we've all experienced one that fell flat. Was it insecure insincerity? Too much equivocating? No real plan to fix the problem? Sometimes, though, we can't quite put a finger on why the words I'm sorry just don't cut it. Well, Karina Schumann researches apologies for a living. She's a professor of sociology and head of the Conflict Resolution Lab at the University of Pittsburgh. And she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides.
Hello, so nice to be here.
So apologies can be hard to give, hard to even receive, but they're worth it, right?
Absolutely. Our research over many decades shows that for the most part, apologies have a tremendous impact on our lives. They help us mend our relationships. They help us go through a process of guilt reduction and self-forgiveness. And they really are necessary in many moments of hardship in our relationships, our close relationships, the ones we value most, as a way to promote healing and to move forward and make the relationship even viable moving forward.
And sometimes swallowing your pride and going first can open the door for the other person to follow, right?
That is right. It can be difficult to be the one to go first for sure, but research does show that once that apology is offered, the person feels validated. When they receive that, they feel heard. And oftentimes, because these conflicts are often more complicated, there isn't a single person who's responsible, it then opens the door to them, for them to then reciprocate with an apology for their part in the problem.
So since they're so important, I think it's important to know how to do it well. So I want to talk about how to give a good apology. And first and foremost, you actually have to apologize, right?
Yeah, so those words, I apologize, I'm sorry, they are really critical, and it's very important that you say those directly and without a bunch of hedging language around it. So it sends the clearest signal to use those words and to really say them in ways that are attached to yourself, right? So I apologize, I am sorry, not just a sorry or, you know, sorry about that kind of thing, you know? That those words are really key to sending the clearest signal to the other person that you are apologizing and accepting responsibility for your behavior.
So then what about phrases like, I want to apologize, or I would like to say I'm sorry?
You know, we tend to use those sometimes, especially when we're writing a formal letter. I'm not sure there's work that, in psychology at least, that's separates those from I apologize more directly, but linguists might know more about that. I think, you know, just don't equivocate, just say directly, I'm sorry, I apologize. It's probably the most powerful way to say it.
And definitely don't say, I'm sorry you felt that way.
No, that's definitely something you want to avoid. It can be tempting to say that when we don't fully understand why the person was hurt, or when we ourselves wouldn't have been hurt in that same situation. So we can be like, oh, I'm sorry that this had this effect on you. I'm sorry that you are having these emotions. But really, that makes the person receiving the apology feel like you're shifting the blame onto them for having this emotional response rather than for taking responsibility for the action that led them to have this emotional response.
So how do we explain what we did wrong? Because that sounds like a key component of this.
This is probably the trickiest part because oftentimes when someone has been harmed, they struggle to make sense of why they were harmed by you, and they want to make meaning out of it, right? They want to understand why you did this to them. Why did you hurt them? Why were you late? Why couldn't you, help them with this assignment, whatever it is. And because of that, we often tend to want to explain ourselves, and it can be a good thing to explain ourselves. The tricky and really challenging part comes in explaining in ways that are non-defensive. So oftentimes we want to explain our, you know, reasons behind our actions, it sounds like excuse making or justifications or even pushing the blame onto them, which is a big no-no. And it's tempting to do that because, you know, oftentimes there are these external situational factors that cause us to behave in certain ways, but also because it really feels good to remove the responsibility from ourselves and to shed our, you know, a more positive light on our actions. And so to explain in ways that are more beneficial and more accurate, it's really important to try to do so in ways that can shed light on your actions, but are still accepting the accountability for those actions. So, you know, try not to say, I'm sorry, but this person made me do it. Try not to say, I'm sorry, but if you had, you know, just helped me with this first, I would have had more time to do, you know, these are things that really remove the power of the apology and reduce its effectiveness. And once you start to use those kinds of statements, the victim or the person who's on the receiving end of the apology tends to sort of shut down and say, okay, they're going into defensive mode here and they're not really apologizing. So you can say things like, this is what happened. This is still, I should have tried harder. It's the fault is still on me. Things like that, that make it clear that you are still accepting accountability for your actions while also trying to explain what happened.
I think sometimes we want to explain what happened because we're almost searching for a little empathy ourselves. Like, we are not the villain entirely in this. So, you know, you have a bad day, you snap at your partner and you say, look, I had an awful day at work. Like, I am sorry, I should not have snapped at you, but I had an awful day at work.
Absolutely. We are searching for that empathy. And actually, research by Nurit Schnabel and Arianne Nadler from 2008 shows that one of the strongest motivations that someone who has hurt someone has, so when you're in this transgressor or offender role, one of the strongest motivations and psychological needs we have is to feel accepted by the other person, is to feel like they empathize with you. And so that is a tremendous need that we have. And we often do go searching for that in the way of these justifying statements and explanations that tries to help the other person understand that we are a good person and to help them empathize with why we did what we did.
So we have to own what we did, but should we say that we didn't mean any harm? That our intentions were good, or we believed our intentions to be good?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a time and place for that without it being like the default that we turn to. So there are going to be situations where it is important to say, this action does not reflect how I feel about you. So what I did was not because I don't care, was not because I disrespect you. There were these other things going on. I know it felt that way, but I never would ever want to hurt you that way. And, you know, that can be important sometimes to communicate to the person that you really do care or what your true intentions were, that they weren't malicious, which can be helpful. But again, it can't be just like something you actually did mean and be like, oh, didn't mean to, sorry about that, and then move on, right? It has to really be coming from an authentic place where you are clarifying to the person that you really do care about them and how your actions didn't reflect your what you really feel for them or what your true intentions were in that situation.
I think sometimes we're quick to jump to that in a situation where we thought that we were joking, but the other person just doesn't find it funny.
That's absolutely a case where that would be something that we do turn to quite quickly and where it probably will fall flat a lot of the time because people often do feel like, yeah, you were joking, but does that reflect what you really mean? So to sort of just brush it off and minimize it by saying, oh, I didn't really mean it that way, can feel like you're not really taking responsibility for the harmfulness of your words.
We got a really interesting email from Michael who wanted to know how effective apologies can be issued by someone or even to someone who is neurodivergent, like somebody who might have autism or ADHD or BPD.
That's a really good question. You know, there is definitely an absence of work in the space of neurodivergence and more generally and also specifically absolutely in the work on apologies as well. I'm not an expert in this, so I can't speak to that question directly. I will say that whenever you're offering an apology more generally, no matter who you're apologizing to, the most important thing to think about is, how is this person going to receive this? How is this person going to hear my apology? And oftentimes when we construct our apologies, we do so for our own needs, right? We say what we think we want to hear in that situation, or we say what we want to say to explain ourselves or to protect ourselves in that situation. But what we really should be doing is designing the apology for the other person. And if you are apologizing to someone who is neurodivergent, and you understand what their needs might be in that situation, and you know them as a person, then to really tailor your apology and design it for them would probably be the best advice I can offer at this state without having research on this topic specifically.
So when it comes to the promise not to do it again, is that important?
If you mean it, you have to mean
that
it.
That is a good
know,
point.
It's going to really backfire if you say it and then you don't change your behavior and you don't try. And, you know, apologies, there's, like I said, decades of work that show that they are really beneficial. But if it really has to come across as sincere and authentic, and as soon as an apology loses that sincerity, it's going to lose its power. And so if you're saying, oh, I promise not to do it again, but you're not investing any effort into actually changing your behavior, or this already is a pattern of repeated behavior and you keep making those promises, then why would the person trust that apology as a sincere promise? You know, so you have to, is it important to say it? It really can help rebuild trust, but the person has to feel like you are authentically committing to that goal of not doing it again. And yeah, we're not going to be perfect. We are going to repeat our mistakes. We do fall into habits and patterns of behavior, but there at least needs to be, you know, this genuine effort behind that promise.
It's basically that, you know, the cliche, actions speak louder than words, is a cliche for a reason.
It is. And I think that, you know, apologies sometimes come across as cheap talk or as, you know, words without substance. And they can be used that way. And that is unfortunate. And so what I really like to encourage people is to think about, when you are in an apology situation, what is it that you can authentically say to this person? What is it that you, while, you know, putting yourself in a position to empathize with this person, what do you genuinely feel? And what can you say to them from a sincere place? And then to also remember that an apology should not be the end of this, you know, repair process, that apologies are often a starting point to this promise of behavioral change, or to, you know, the words that go along something that is more substantive in terms of something that you can do to repair or make up this harm that you've committed. So to not think of apologies as the only thing that needs to be done here. It is a very important thing that needs to be done, especially for more severe offenses, but that there are a lot of behavioral things that need to go to coincide or follow that apology as well.
And last but certainly not least, when it comes to apologizing, we have to accept if people don't accept our apologies.
This is tricky for sure. And there is research showing that we have, as when we apologize, we expect forgiveness, and that we're sort of upset with the other person and think badly of them if they don't forgive us. And just as a society, you know, we have a lot of pressure to forgive, and apologies and forgiveness are so closely connected and tethered to each other that sometimes it can seem that, like, when someone doesn't forgive someone, they're being ungenerous. They're not following this social script of what they're supposed to do after they've received an apology. And that might make them seem immoral, or like they're not a good relationship partner, or they're not very, you know, benevolent or generous, like I said. So this is really important for us to let go of this expectation of forgiveness once we have apologized to someone, to give them this time and space to heal, to take away this pressure from them, because really part of offering an authentic apology is for it to be offered for the reasons that are healthy and constructive in the relationship, which is to heal the harm that has been caused and not to necessarily just expect to be forgiven immediately and move on and wipe the slate clean. And it's also really important to remember that what the person who's been harmed feels is probably more intense than what you see as them experiencing. And so an apology that you offer might not really be the complete package in terms of what they need to heal and process. So yes, be respectful of that need that they have, give them time and space. And remember that an apology is one part of a larger process of reconciliation.
That was Karina Schumann, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you for listening to All Sides this hour. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And that'll do it for this hour here on 89.7 NPR News. Listen to On